This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Rich Robinson tells us what a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision could mean for elections in Michigan this year. But first, a recent study raises questions about the quality of virtual schools, as well as how they are funded. The report from the National Education Policy Center was released in March. Two Western Michigan University researchers contributed to the study. Gary Miron is a professor of evaluation, measurement, and research. Brian Horvitz is a professor of educational technology. Both are in Western's College of Education. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Gordon.
What did you look at in this study specifically when it comes to online education?
We focused on full-time virtual schools at the kindergarten to 12th grade level. So we haven't focused on the delivery of individual courses. We haven't looked at the hybrid models, schools that are part online and part face-to-face. We have focused just on the full-time virtual schools where these schools get the full dollar for the full education.
And what specifically did you find in terms of, let's kind of go through these one by one, quality?
Well, we looked at a number of outcome measures, and across the board, our findings suggest that these schools are not performing well, and these findings haven't changed over the last few years.
Specifically, coming up short in test scores compared to traditional schools?
We looked at a number of outcome measures in various reports. This report now, we focus mostly on state performance ratings for schools, but we have looked at other measures of adequate yearly progress, attrition, dropout, graduation rates. We've also just looked at direct comparison of math and reading scores over time and where they go. Across all the measures, the virtual schools are falling behind. And students, we can see, are actually losing ground, particularly in math.
Diversity.
The schools are not as diverse as brick-and-mortar charter schools, and they're far from being as diverse as the traditional public schools. Fewer children of color, fewer low-income students, very few students with disabilities or English language learners.
Accountability.
A lot of them are, in fact, 80% of the students in these schools are enrolled in schools that are operated by for-profit companies, and these private companies are not very transparent. So in terms of accountability, it's more difficult to understand how they're using our public dollars. And also, but when we look at the outcomes, we're seeing that they cannot demonstrate success or any good use of those dollars given the weak outcomes.
How different is that from, say, some of the charter schools, which are also run by for-profit companies?
Charter schools, there's every year there's another study looking, and we're going back and forth on whether they're successful or not. We've done a synthesis of more than 70 of the nation's studies on charter schools, and we find that they generally perform at levels similar to or slightly worse than matched students or matched schools in the traditional public school sector. So there was one really rigorous study done by a research center out of Stanford. This was for the state of Pennsylvania, one of the states with the most virtual, full-time virtual school students, and they found that the virtual school students in all eight of these very large full-time virtual schools, they were far behind the charter schools, and the charter school students were slightly behind the district schools. And this was a matched student design tracking one-year change results over multiple years.
Now, let's stay here for full disclosure. Both of you gentlemen teach classes online here at Western Michigan University. Brian is an educator. Do you find some value in that?
Absolutely. Online learning creates access for students who might not have it otherwise, and there are creative uses for the kinds of technologies that people are using in learning environments. Creates instructional design opportunities to do things with students you might not otherwise, to work with students who maybe are less comfortable in the classroom, who might have language issues. But it also creates challenges for students who have self-regulation issues or motivation issues. I've taught online courses here at Western with varying success depending really on the kind of students I'm working with.
Oh, is there a certain type of student who this does seem to work well for?
Those who are able to self-regulate, those who are able to organize their time better, who are able to work efficiently without having to check in face-to-face with a teacher on a weekly basis.
What are the numbers on Michigan's online schools, Gary?
Well, we have, if you go back a few years, we had only two full-time virtual schools. And those were pilot schools, and the state was undergoing a multi-year pilot study to see how do these schools work. And it was a very responsible policy process where they were going to look at how to hold these schools accountable and also look at the actual cost so that they could create a reasonable funding formula for these schools. After 2 years of the pilot study, all outcome measures that were available to the public that we could see were negative. It wasn't working, and the legislature decided to lift the cap on virtual schools. Today, we have 16 virtual schools in the state, at least in 2012-13, that may have gone up. And only three of them have acceptable ratings in the school performance system in our state. So the results haven't really changed, going from a pilot study of two schools to now to 16.
Are there ways of providing accountability? That's one of the things you talk about in the study, the lack of accountability. Is there a way to try and make these schools more accountable?
Well, I think it's, with so many of them run by for-profit companies, these private companies, I think this is a good, this is a great concern because of their performance, but also the lack of transparency. And I think that's one thing that we have to ensure, that there's independent and strong boards that are running these virtual charter schools, in most cases, or charter schools rather than district schools. There's got to be more safeguards put in place to ensure that if they're not operating, that the board can separate with those for-profit companies. But that's very difficult to do.
Why is it difficult to do?
Because everything is private. The school, the learning platform, the name of the school, when you look at the contracts, everything is proprietary. Anything the teacher develops doesn't belong to the public virtual charter school. It belongs to the privately operated company. So that's a real concern. It's very hard to break with these for-profit companies because, you know, it's supposed to be a small local group that opens the virtual charter school and then invites in a vendor or an education management organization. But in reality, it's the private company going out, doing a market analysis, deciding where to set up their schools. The teachers are private employees. Again, the learning platform, everything belongs to the company, not to the public charter school board or the public district board. In a few cases, districts have hired these companies.
Both of you as educators, do you think that there is something that becomes a real different ball game when we talk about someone entirely attending school online as opposed to taking a class or two classes online? Brian?
Certainly, there's going to be trade-offs between access, which is great, but students who aren't meeting face-to-face with teachers, who aren't working collaboratively face-to-face with students, certainly there's interactions that aren't happening. Now, online learning can be designed in all sorts of different ways. Teachers can approach it asynchronously so that students are working in their own time, or synchronously where they're doing real-time video. So certainly there are multiple ways to do this, and teachers and educational researchers are experimenting with all sorts of different designs. But it is such a new kind of environment that one of my concerns is that there is such a acceleration in the creation of so many of these programs, and there's still a lot more work to be done on how to do this well, how to train teachers to design good programs, how to train them, how to work with students in a way that they never have learned themselves. So there's a lot of work to be done, and yet there's what feels like a land rush to build more programs.
And Gary, is that why, in part, you and some other researchers have said that states should be going slow on expanding online education?
Yeah, we've said going slow. We've also said stop. Let's stop the growth because it's not working. We believe that it can work. We just believe that we need to stop, have a moratorium on these schools, and then figure out the right accountability mechanisms and also the right funding mechanisms so that we can start rolling out this reform in a successful way. But in the big picture, there's three types of virtual schools, and it's important to distinguish them, or three types of virtual school provision. One is the delivery of individual courses, and I think there's more improvement that can be done there, but lots of schools across the country, especially rural schools, especially small schools, are taking advantage of this, signing up, and kids can enroll in one or more courses online. That's one type of provision. And then the other extreme are the full-time virtual schools, which we've been focusing on in our research. But in between, there's a great area of opportunity, and that's with the blended models or the hybrid models, where the school students are at a brick-and-mortar school part of the time, and then part of the time they're getting the instruction virtually from their home. And this has tremendous potential for saving money for the public school system. It has great potential for taking better advantage of the technologies and new communication means. So this is pretty exciting. We need to do research. We need to test these ideas, but we're seeing across the country, on a very small scale, we're seeing a lot of new models of hybrid learning appearing, and we believe that's going to be the future. That's where we're going. The full-time virtual schools, they're an anomaly. They are driven by for-profit companies and private interest. I think we'll always have them. I think we're always, but I think there's far too many students in these schools, and many of them would probably benefit more from a blended model where they can have more face-to-face contact with adults and with other children.
But, I mean, you brought up the idea of saving money. I mean, you save a lot more if you don't actually have to build a school, right?
Yeah. When we look at our report, we also look at the teacher-student ratios, and you can see their biggest savings is not only in not having to provide transportation, not having to do a lunch program, not having to do a facility, but actually the teacher-student ratios are more than twice what we see in the brick-and-mortar schools. And that's what their self-reported information is. We know from some of our research that in some schools, virtual schools, they have 120 or more students per teacher. That's a tremendous cost savings. Again, the outcome is not very positive, so obviously they should be investing more there. But when they can, they will cut corners because they're for-profit companies, and they are profiting, which is what for-profit companies do.
And research is pretty clear that students benefit from a smaller student-teacher ratio.
Online or otherwise?
Exactly.
Regardless of what your report may say, regardless of what policymakers may desire, is it fair to say that we can expect that there will be a growth in online education? Is that the trend line right now?
There is. We saw from just slightly over 300 schools last year, we saw it climbed to 338 in 2012-13. And then if we look at the student growth now, we went from 200,000 students in full-time virtual schools now to 250,000. So we're seeing pretty rapid growth, much sharper growth in the virtual school sector, the full-time virtual schools, compared to the brick-and-mortar charter schools. We're seeing much more rapid growth in that sector. And it's a lot easier for these for-profit companies to grow in the virtual school sector because, think about it, if you're going to start a new brick-and-mortar school, you need to have a lot of money for a facility. You need to have a contract with a large group of teachers, and there's a big financial commitment. You're taking a risk when you expand your private network of charter schools. When you do it virtually, we see these companies taking risky decisions, but they're not risking a lot of capital because it doesn't cost a lot. They have a learning platform that's set up, and it's going to cost, very incrementally more, whether, if you have 10,000 students or 100,000 students. But also with the teachers, what we're seeing, that they've found ways that they hire mostly part-time teachers, and they can have them anywhere in the state or even outside the state. So they're not taking a risk like hiring a core of teachers, committing to them for at least a year as a school opens. Because if the school doesn't open, which sometimes it doesn't, they just shift that labor virtually to another school. So it's a very, for the for-profit companies, it's a very profitable area with minimal risk in terms of capital investment.
And in some cases, the teachers that they're hiring aren't necessarily even trained teachers. They don't even always call them teachers. They can be, I think I've heard, coaches or instructors, but they're not people who have gone to school to learn, to get certified as teachers. So that's also something that would be good to look into.
I'm sure there's some people that would hear this conversation and the constant references to for-profit companies running the schools and say, so what? If they can run a school that's an alternative to what's in my neighborhood, which I don't think is a great school, why not? If they make a profit off it, what do I as a parent care?
Yeah. We have seen a shift across the nation in the last two decades in this notion of what is public, the notion of publicness, where it's shifted, where and legally it hasn't shifted that much, but in public opinions, where people used to think a public school had to be publicly owned, publicly governed, and pursue public good. And now we're seeing that a shift where it seems to be acceptable for a school to be privately owned, privately governed, often having somewhat selective populations of students coming in, so not necessarily a public student body, but they're publicly funded, even though they're private in other aspects. And we seem to accept that now, and we see that with more than 80% of our schools in the state, charter schools in the state of Michigan, now being operated by for-profit companies. But so there has been a shift. But the important thing is whether they're going to be public or private, or known that way, is are they delivering a public good? And when we look at the outcomes of these schools, they are not delivering a public good because they are not successful. And again, across all outcome measures, we have strong concerns about their performance. If there are some outcome measures that were positive and some that were negative, well, we don't have that picture. Across all outcome measures for full-time virtual schools at the kindergarten to 12th grade level, they are negative and demonstrate weak performance.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you.
Gary Miron is a professor of evaluation, measurement, and research in Western Michigan University's College of Education. Brian Horvitz is a professor of educational technology. They both contributed to a report on virtual schools for the National Education Policy Center.